Right, well, hello everyone, and thank you for coming. by the way, is this in focus? It's not, is it?
You can zoom in.
Yes.
Okay, let's go ahead first.
All right. I'm sure it's
good. If it's not working, just take that thing off, okay? The thing underneath, that's the problem. Whatever you attach there, the white
thing.
Yeah, that's if that's not the problem, then your view graphs are all right.
All right.
I doubt.
All right, well, I'll make a start,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so I'm going to be talking to you about work that I've just done to complete my PhD thesis. Of course, it's on neutron stars, I wouldn't be here, but it's also on gravitational wave stuff. And I know that we're not all lucky enough to be doing gravitational wave type things, so I thought I'd just make a few remarks about what all the fuss is about and why we're doing it and why I'm doing this. So the picture is this, that we've been looking one way or another for gravitational waves since about the 1960s. They haven't been detected yet, but there's a new batch of laser interferometer type machines that are hopefully going to start taking good data in the next year or two. Some in Europe, some in America, and one in Japan. And the point of it all is that if we ever do see a gravitational wave signal in one of our machines, we're probably not going to see it very cleanly. Instead, it's going to be buried under an awful lot of noise. And so the hope is that by looking at all the sorts of different sources that we might see in these machines and learning as much as we can about them, we can aid our search to dig into all this noisy data and all this rubbish that we're not interested in and figure out those bits that we are interested in. So the whole idea of my thesis was to look at this idea of whether or not freely processing neutron stars are interesting gravitational wave sources. And of course, neutron stars are such complicated things that you can't necessarily do this terribly well. So in the main, what I'll be doing is looking at this very complicated physics, but just extracting the main timescales in more or less an order of magnitude way, and trying to assess whether or not it's worth us in the next few years looking for these signals in our data. And so the story I'm going to tell you breaks down rather neatly into three parts. The first part, I'll basically describe how to think about a freely processing neutron star. In other words, set up a model for the free precession. In the second part, I'll then, this is the bad part, this is the part where I look at those things that tend to kill off the free precession, the stop the star processing. And then in the third and final part of the talk, well, that's the good stuff, that's where I look at things that might keep the free precession alive and ask the question, are they going to be strong enough to counteract the things that tend to decrease the free precession? And so I should also make clear what is meant by free precession. So to give a local, so free precession is the most general motion of a spinning body that's got some degree of solidity or rigidity. And so a local example, so I thought I'd give one, would be when a quarterback throws a football, he tries to throw it so that when it spins through the air, it's doing it in a very simple way, it's just spinning about its axis. But of course, if he doesn't put his hand in, apply the pressure in the right way, you can see it wobbling as it travels through the air. In fact, what's happening is that the symmetry axis is moving, tracing out a cone in space, and that's free precession. It's basically a wobbling motion of a solid body. All right, so that's the sort of plan of the talk. And so first of all, I'm going to set up the model of free precession. Unfortunately, in this, it's possible to be guided a great deal by ideas that people have had concerning the Earth itself. I mean, in all branches of neutron star physics, there are going to be analogies with the Earth. But I think in free precession, the analogies are particularly rich and helpful. So what I've done in this table is set up a comparison. So First of all, the Earth has five moments of inertia, a solid crust that makes up about 90% of its moment of inertia, and a liquid core that makes up something like 10%. Now, in neutron stars, the situation is reversed, which from a pre-precession point of view is bad, because you want the solid bit there, because that's the thing that does the precessing. So neutron stars, depends on the mass, depends on what the right equation of state is, but they'll have more than 90% in the liquid, and most of the rest in the solid. Now, the Earth has in fact got a solid core as well. Now, no one knows if neutron stars have got solid cores, but if they have, then we can extend this analogy even further. But I'm not going to be looking at any solid cores like the one I'm going to be there. Push the analogy from further, there are oceans on the Earth. There will be oceans on neutron stars as well, but they'll make up a very small fraction of the total mass. So they're probably not, they're hopefully not terribly important in the pre-precession problem. As I say, you've got to have some sort of rigidity for a body to be able to process. And for the Earth, because it's mainly solid, the Earth's a fairly rigid sort of thing. And you can write down a number that characterizes just how rigid it is. And I think I'll take just 1 or 2 minutes to explain what that number is. The idea is this. If you're thinking about forming a neutron star, then you can imagine taking a very hot component, a completely liquid neutron star, and either by spinning it or physically putting your hands on it, you can give it some really non-spherical oblate shape. And say that shape's epsilon naught. And you let it solidify. And then you take your hands away. And what's going to happen then is there'll be a battle between gravity that wants to make this thing spherical, and rotation, if you give it some rotation, that tends to make it a plate. And then, crucially, there are forces, there are crystalline forces in the crust that tend to make the thing have a shape of epsilon naught, the shape that I've drawn up there. And so what will happen is that because gravity is rather strong, you'll end up with a star that isn't really as fat and a plate as when it started, and you'll have some other what I call a blateness epsilon. So these numbers epsilon are just a measure of how non-spherical the thing is. And you can easily estimate just how non-spherical the star will be by writing down its energy function. And so the total energy of this spinning star with a strain crust will be something like this. That it will consist of the energy of the spherical star. It will consist of a gravitational piece, which will be some constant times epsilon squared, because a non-spherical configuration always have a higher gravitational energy than a spherical one. There'll be another piece, which is a strain energy, which goes as some constant times, or the shape it's actually got, minus the shape that the crust would like to have, squared. And then there's another piece again, which is just the kinetic energy. Let me rewrite that. Alright, so that's the energy of our spinning star. A is a number that's to do with the gravitational energy, and it will be of order the total gravitational energy of the star. B is a number to do with how thick the crust is and what sort of ions are making it up. It's to do with the strain energy, and this is just the kinetic piece. And well, in order to figure out just what shape the star will have, you can do a simple thing, and you can set the rates of change of energy with the shape parameter epsilon at fixed angular momentum equal to naught. And if you do that, then you find that the actual shape of the star epsilon consists of two pieces. The first part looks like this. So the first part is a piece that depends basically on the on the ratio of the kinetic and the gravitational energy, and there'll be some other bit which has to do with these strains in the crust. And so the point is that when you look at the shape of the star, there's a piece that's to do with the centrifugal forces, and then there's a piece that's to do with the strain forces in the crust. And what's going to happen for at least a sufficiently fast spinning star is that these centrifugal forces are going to be a fair bit bigger than the distortion forces. And so the actual ability of the crust to change the shape of the star isn't very big. And you can parameterize just how big the crust is at overcoming these gravitational forces that want to make it spherical by looking at this dimensionless coefficient here, which I put on the view graph. So this is a thing that's called a rigidity parameter. It's basically the binding energy of all the ions in the crust over the gravitational potential energy of the star. And as I say, for the Earth, because the Earth's a fairly rigid sort of thing, that number comes out at about 0.7. Unfortunately, for neutron stars, it comes out at being much less than 1, about 10 to the minus 5. So this is the origin for the sort of statement you might have heard, that neutron star crusts are more like jelly than they're like metals. They're simply not very rigid at all. So that's how to think about a star that's distorted by strains in its crust. Of course, there's another way in which you can distort an object by putting a magnetic field in, which we've already talked about this week. And of course, for the Earth, magnetic strains aren't important, but for neutron stars, if their field's big enough, then they certainly will be important. It all depends on how big the field is inside the star. And the million-dollar question is, do we know which things in the universe, which astronomical objects really precess? Well, the answer for the Earth is yes, it has a pre-precession period of 14 months called the Chandler wobble. And I've got to say that this isn't very well understood, because this wobble, it seems, should buy out in something like 10 years or a few decades at most. Of course, the Earth's a hell of a lot older than that. You've got to ask yourself, what on earth's keeping it alive? And it simply isn't a very well understood question. So I'm going to be looking at this sort of thing for neutron stars. Well, I should say at the outset that the corresponding problem for the Earth isn't overly well understood, so it's not the easiest thing to do. So as for neutron stars, there are a handful of known stars that may well be fully precessing, including one recent observation by Spares, Schumer and Lyon, which is a particularly good observation and a rather exciting one, a rather timely one, in which they think they've seen a neutron star, and they've seen quite a few oscillations in things like the amplitude of the rate of the pulsation and the timing, so that they're pretty confident that they at last found a good candidate for free precession. Right, so those are the analogies between the terrestrial problem and neutron stars. The key point to take from this is that the Earth's rather rigid, but for neutron stars, well, there is some rigidity, but it's not very much, they're rather jelly-like, and the magnetic field may be important, depending on how strong it is within the star.
Is jelly really the right analogy? Jelly is a substance that you can reform a lot before it breaks.
To make the analogy better, it's a jelly with a very low breaking strain. That's what you mean.
Exactly. Yeah. Breaking strain is not really relevant in this comparison.
Is it more of a gel than a jelly?
Well, it will flow past plastically under certain conditions, of course. It's a jelly with a low breaking strain. I think that's an accurate way of putting it.
So I guess none of the asbestos, but of course the neutron star in superfluid.
I did mean to mention that. The pin part of a superfluid would have to go into the free precession model as well, and would be extremely important. And much of what I'm doing, I've not put the pin part in, but you can work out after the work of people like Shaham, what effect it has. And basically, I'm going to come up with pessimistic conclusions for the gravitational waves, and they would be even more pessimistic if I put this pin stuff in. So it's going to strengthen the conclusion of our connection. Right, so very, very briefly, the free precession model for a rigid body, it's easy. You can write the body's moment of inertia tensor as consisting of a spherical part plus a quadrupolar part, completely rigidly fixed with respect to all the atoms that make up the body. So in this model here, if a free precession body's got an angular momentum J, and if angular is the symmetry axis, then for a rigid body, this quadrupolar piece points along the symmetry axis, and you can characterize the magnitude of the free precession by this wobble angle theta, the angle between these two axes. For an elastic body, or jelly-like body, the situation is more complicated. just as well as there being a spherical part, as well as there being parts, quadrupolar part fixed with respect to the crust, there's going to be a large centrifugal piece as well. So in terms of what I wrote on the blackboard earlier, the quadrupolar part along there, along the symmetry axis, is this small piece here. And then the other part, the large, big, fat centrifugal piece, is the first one here. And you've got to put both of those in to understand the free procession. And then there's one other important thing that you've got to realize is that because the neutron star is mainly fluid, as the crust processes, it's going to be pressed into the fluid. So you've got to try and, in some way, model that interaction between the liquid and the solid parts. And that's a problem that has been looked at for the Earth, at least in a certain simple limiting case. So those are the sort of ingredients that you are that you have to put in to come up, and then you should put pin in as well, probably to make a realistic model of free procession.
In the case of the elastic body, if you have no quadrupolar part along in, then it won't process at all. Right?
Yeah. That would, say, correspond simply to a plain fluid with no other interesting bits of physics in it. Alright, so that's the free procession model. But there's one important point that we've got to extract from this model, which is, this was raised by a question earlier, which is, if you've got a body and you start increasing its precession angle, so it's not sort of moving in a tiny little cone, it's moving around in a huge great big cone, then you might imagine that that's going to stress the crust in some way, and that's going to be important. And the way to understand this, this has been looked at in some detail for axisymmetric stars, including a recent paper by Hashimoto, Cutler, and Goldstein. But for free precession, the thing to realize is this, that if you're sitting on the crust, if you're, say, tied to an ion in the crust, then you're going to see the angular momentum vector of your spin moving with respect to the crust, moving past you in some sort of cone. And because these centrifugal forces are continually changing the shape of the star, it's going to have, it means that you're continually changing all the stresses out of that. And so eventually, if this free procession angle is big enough, you're going to increase the stresses enough, you're going to break the star. You're going to crack the crust, in other words. And so you can just make a simple argument about how large these changes in shape are going to be for a given precession angle. And what you'll find is that for a given spin frequency and for a given crustal breaking strain, there'll be a maximum wobble angle. And the faster you spin the star, the larger the centrifugal bulge that you've got to keep moving around. And so the smaller the wobble angle at which the crust breaks. Okay, so faster spinning stars, but bigger bulges to reorientate, and therefore there's going to be bigger strains for a given wobble angle. So that's important. That's going to help us, in the next part, put an upper bound on the gravitational wind amplitude for a star.
So, but the distortion of each point of the star, if you're sitting on it, changes as a function of time.
Exactly.
That sort of a characteristic.
Yeah, it will change. It will change at the slow body frame pre-precession frequency. And then, of course, the exact way in which it changes, you have to solve the problem properly, which I've not done. I've just extracted the order of magnitude by looking at the geometry in a simple way. All right. So, as I said, if you know the maximum wobble angle that a star can have, and you know its spin frequency, and you know how far away it is, then you can plug all of this in to the Max quadrupole formulas of general relativity, they get a guess on just how strongly a given star with a given deformation delta I can radiate. So that's important. This is going to tell us how interesting these sorts of sources can be as gravitational wave emitters.
So, what are the gravitational waves you can imagine the star not wobbling at all, it's still emitting gravitational waves.
Yeah, if it's triaxial, yeah. So if you've got a mountain, say, sitting on the equator, then it would do that, yeah. So I'm not looking at that sort of problem. I'm looking at a body that, when it isn't processing, would be completely axisymmetric. And then, say, you come along, you kick it, and it starts wobbling. So there are two ways a spinning star can emit waves, because it's triaxial, because it's sort of mounting on it, or because it's fully processing, or, of course, because of rock.
But the omega, sorry, but omega in your H formula is the omega spin.
That's the spin frequency of the star. And for free precession, you get radiation emitted both at the spin frequency and at twice that. But if the angle's small, then it's mainly just at the spin frequency. That's why it's only a spin in that formula.
So the gravitational waves that you're talking about come out at the spin frequency, but they're modulating at the
precession. No, but they can simply come out at the spin frequency. The electromagnetic waves might be radiated, but in the simplest possible picture, the gravitational wave frequency would be completely steady. Because, I'd like to have a big prop like an American football or something, but if I say it's my coffee mug, I've got to be careful because there's still coffee in it. So if this is the symmetry axis of the star up here, then it's simply wobbling around like that. But ignore the handle of the cup, because that would be a mountain, and you don't want that. But if you just look at this thing moving in a cone, then you're going to see radiation from where you're sitting at the frequency at which this cone rotates once about the invariant angular momentum axis.
That's the precession frequency.
Well, that's what I call the inertial. The whole concept of a spin frequency for a rotating body, you've got to be careful. Now, there's a frequency at which the symmetry axis traces out a cone, and that technically isn't the spin frequency. It's what I call the inertial precession frequency. And there's another frequency called the body frame free precession frequency, at which this whole body slowly rotates about the symmetry axis. And then there's also a less well-defined thing, which you could simply call the spin frequency, which would be the frequency at which you see electromagnetic radiation from where you're sitting, and that is modulated. But the gravitational wave ones aren't.
So which one of those frequencies is the gravitational waves?
At the inertial precession frequency, and also slightly at twice that. It's easy to see.
Right, so I guess that's what I was asking. So you're saying, from infinity, what's changing is that precession frequency.
Exactly. But the mass quadrupole is rotating at what I call the inertial precession frequency.
Right.
So it's the frequency at which the symmetry axis of the body moves in a cone.
Sorry, I don't mean to slow you down, but what I don't understand is it won't process at all unless it has a mount on it.
No, but that's not.
It has to have some kind of.
It's got some sort of rigidity. Yeah. But I mean, an American football processes, but it's not because it's triaxial, it's just because it's axisymmetric. It's because it's not spherical. So you've got
it. It's spherical, that's right.
Yeah.
But that's also going to, that asphericity is in general going to also produce gravitational waves at the spin frequency, where spin frequency is like 33.
If you take a rigid body,
yes.
Let's say an American football, and you throw it up in the air, you'll just get the gravitational waves at the inertial precession frequency.
Yeah, I mean, if you're spinning like this, yes. What's changing? You're not seeing any quantum changes. What's going on?
Well, if it's completely axisymmetric,
yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And that goes over fairly accurately, even when you put these extra bits of physics in. Okay.
And another question: when you have a free processing and the actually symmetric body, but which is also elastic, doesn't become triaxial.
Its instantaneous shape is triaxial.
But
that's right.
You can neglect this effect in Earth's level.
In the simplest way of modeling an elastic body, it actually processes just like a rigid one. But the only piece of the body that's causing the free precession is the what I call the, it's not the big centrifugal piece. It's not the big quadrupolar centrifugal deformation, it's the other one. So if you just forget about the centrifugal one and only let the much smaller part, the much smaller deformation due, say, to the crustal forces, then it's a sort of a correspondence between the elastic and the rigid.
So you can separate.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I should pass on, I think. I think I'd better put that formula back out, because you've forgotten it, and I suspect I may have too. So the whole point was, this argument about maximum wobble angles, is that if you plunge this maximum angle into the simple formula giving a gravitational wave amplitude, you get a maximum gravitational wave amplitude for a star spinning at a given frequency with a given deformation in its inertia tensor, and of course at a particular distance from the Earth. And so if you plug all that in, you get an upper band of the magnitude. And what I'm going to do in the next few diagrams is show you some examples of these maximum amplitudes. So in this first view graph here, I'm thinking about stars where its strain force is in the crust that are making it, enabling it to precess quickly. This is what I've got plotted here, a signal in noise curves for a gravitational wave detector. So on the horizontal axis, there's the frequency of the wave. On the vertical axis, it's the noise in the detector, and also the strength of the signal. And you can see a whole lot of curves on here, sort of U-shaped curves. These correspond to the various gravitational wave detectors. Points above those curves are detectable by the detector, and points below are undetectable. And so the top curves here are from the sorts of machines that we hope will be working in a year or two. And then this lower curve corresponding to a more sensitive detector is many more years away, but planned for and people thinking about how to build it. So on top of these noise curves, I've plotted three signal curves. As I say, they're all for stars that are distorted by forces in their crust. And we think that for a realistic neutron star, its rigidity parameter is about 10 to the minus 5. So for a star with such a rigidity parameter, it traces out this curve here of maximal gravitational wave amplitude for free precession. And so you can see it gets a bit above the most advanced detector. The frequency is well over 100 Hz, but it isn't terribly optimistic. If neutron stars are, for one reason or another, a bit more rigid than we think they are, if this parameter is 10 to the minus 4, well, then perhaps even the detectors that we're working with you have got some hope, in principle, of detecting these things.
Why is there a kink in the
plot? Yeah, so the kink is there because at sufficiently low frequencies, you don't get any upper band on the wobble angle. Because if the star isn't from cross cracking, so they're spinning so slowly that they can process as much as they want without it cracking. So
what's the ground that goes that runs along the curve?
Do you mean these?
Yeah. What's the tunable ground that runs down the curve?
The x-axis. So the spin frequency.
It gives you the maximum wobble angle. You're presuming that it goes. It's wobbles from the maximum.
That's right.
So
yeah. So in general, as you increase the frequency, you increase the wave amplitude, but subject to this slight change in behavior, where you have to start worrying about the fact that the start of the crust contraction. Just remember, Ben.
Question, Ricky's got a question.
Sure.
Since the question is
how
does some sort of starting it into succession, is that
I'll repeat the question. I was asked what assumption have I made about how it came into free precession. For instance, if I assume that they just started off at birth with this maximum wobble angle, what I've done here is I've taken out all considerations of why it might be precessing, and I just assume that it's precessing at its maximum wobble angle at a given frequency. And in the last part of my talk, I'll answer just your question, which is why on earth would it be precessing? I mean, that's the million-dollar question.
And it's but these are reasons based on my question. These are not evolutionary curves.
No.
It's possible. Yeah.
That's right. Let me say again. These are curves in which I plot the maximum wave amplitude that's consistent with neutron star structure.
So in other words, if you found a free precessing neutron star, you could actually place a limit on how fast it was initially rotating.
No, because it doesn't. Most of the energy that's lost in free precession is lost in decreasing the wobble angle rather than decreasing the spin frequency. These aren't evolutionary tracks at all. These are just curves based on what we think about neutron star structure.
Right, but if there's a certain amount of deformation, it couldn't have been rotating faster than a certain amount of broken.
Right, I see what you mean. Yes, you could begin to make that sort of statement. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But the problem is these are maximums, so you can have lots of stuff that's lower, and then you wouldn't know much
information. No, but you would measure a certain deformation, right?
Yeah.
Even if it's not the maximum deformation, because if there is the maximum, what are the frequency at which that is the maximum?
What you'd measure, actually, is the product of two numbers, which is the shape it had in the distant past times some small rigidity parameter. So you also have to try and separate out those two factors that go in making up the whole thing. Right, so these are just upper bounds based on what we think about neutron star structure. There's no sort of scenario physics in there. I'm not assuming a particular thing keeping a wobble alive. It's just about structure. Right. I've drawn a similar graph here for what happens if a star is deformed by a magnetic field. The only thing you need to extract from this diagram is that you need pretty good, well-known fit result anyway, but in free precession you need fairly big internal magnetic fields to make the star sufficiently non-spherical to have much hope of detecting it. So this signal curve here is for a star with an internal field of 10 to the 15.5 GeV, and the lower curve is 10 to the 14.5, the intermediate one is 10 to the 15 GeV. So you need pretty big fields for these objects, even in principle, even as an upper bound, to be interesting. Well, again, there are kinks in the curve corresponding to the star spinning rapidly and being limited by the maximum wobble angle. It's basically just the same as the last plot, but with magnetic tension deforming the star rather than. But I'm assuming that the crust is getting deformed by the magnetic field as well.
The whole structure of the star.
Yes.
The crust is secondary importance.
Yes, but it's still the case that you'd expect the crust to crack in a fully precession star, even if it's magnetic fields for the deforming. Because the crust has to change shape during free precession. Because the angular velocity vector in free precession, by definition, is moving in a cone.
Isn't Gary's point that magnetic field imposes an axis which could be different from the spin axis?
There is no influence. The crust is just dynamically
unimportant. Well, it's definitely the case that the crust is going to have to sort of sit on top of the fluid. I mean, there's got to be essentially the same shape, okay? And so if the star's fully precessing, the angular velocity vector moves around. That's what free precession essentially means. And so I know that it isn't important that the crust is magnetically stressed, but what is important is that the crust changes shape. Okay? And so if at one instant the angular velocity vector is over here relative to the crust, so there's a big bulge in the orthogonal plane, then half a free precession period later, the angular velocity vector is over here, and you've got a big bulge in this plane. And so the shape of the star has changed.
Is this a matter of because of gravitational waves or precession? Precession, you don't need to actually change, you need to be different.
I don't understand.
If you get a big no crust, you just have a magnetic field and your spin axis and misaligned, things will process.
Yeah,
well, it won't radiate gravitational waves.
No, I'm not thinking about that scenario. I'm saying that I'm looking at relatively realistic case where there is a crust, and I'm saying that crust changes shape, and eventually it will crack.
The point is, what's wrong with the crust? So it will crack, but it will not place enough limit on the wobble axis.
Well, I'm not sure what would happen after it cracked. I wouldn't claim to be able to follow that sort of physics. I mean, it's going to break, and it's going to...
The crust will have no shape, under the influence of an additional forces due to the magnetic field will be a new equilibrium that it can take.
I wouldn't claim to be able to track what happens to the physics after the crust cracking, so I thought it was safest to place an upper bound on the wobble angle by that.
I think the source of confusion is with that if the star is intrinsically triaxial due to the magnetic field, it could potentially align with the long and short axis, and then still be a gravity wave source.
Yeah, yes, I'm not thinking about that. That's
I know.
All of the definitions
deal with
the magnetic field. And I agree. I understand the point you're making. But what I'm saying is that I don't really know what will happen after the crust cracks. I don't know what will happen to all the relative orientations of the vectors that are important in this problem. And therefore, the safe thing is to assume that that's an upper limit. I mean, what you're saying is that you're not convinced on that, and these are continuous straight lines. But I would doubt that. For a start, you're going to lose. You're probably going to lose the phase of the precession, and so it'd be difficult to track it in a matched filter, for instance. All right. So that completes the first, but hopefully the longest part of my talk, which is an outline of a model of free precession. And so I'm going to go on to the second part, which is about what things will tend to damp the free precession. And so I'm going to start off talking about what I call internal dissipation, which again is a relatively well-studied problem. So the idea is here that you've got processes internal to the star that tend to decrease the wobble angle as a function of time. And people have looked at a few different things that might do this. But the whole point is that if you've, say, got a precessing crust, and if you've got a fluid inside it that isn't participating in the free precession, there's a velocity mismatch between the crust and between the fluid. And so this relative velocity, well, first of all, it could set up a viscous boundary layer, but also there'll be some sort of mutual friction type force here as well. And that's going to sap energy away from the free precession. And people, mainly by thinking about glitches and fitting some post-glitch behavior, have got some idea of how strong they think these forces are in stars. And so if you make the assumption that the free precession is going to be damped in sort of an analogous way due to this velocity mismatch, it's after a glitch, you get a picture of just how strong this damping of free precession would be. And it's almost certainly the case that this so-called mutual friction force is the most important thing that would tend to damp free precession. And Alpar and Soares in 88 estimated that the free precession would be damped in somewhere between 100 and 10 to the 4 free precession. So that's a fairly plausible range for how quickly the free precession would be damped. But this is probably the least well understood of the ideas that go into making understanding free precession.
So the fluid that moves past the crust moves at the speed of response to the free, to the body frame precession.
I think it probably would, yeah. This isn't something that people have talked about much, but I think there would be a relatively slow change. If you were an individual particle sitting in the crust, then you're basically moving in a big circle, a big fast circle, at close to the spin frequency, but you're also moving up and down a bit as well. There's this up and down motion that's the sort of relative velocity field. And it's probably that velocity field that's responsible for the dissipation, that mismatch in velocity fields.
I'm not familiar with the paper by Alpar and Soares, but I suppose Shaham emphasized that the combination of the fluid core and solid crust gave rise to two mutational normal modes, free mutations. One of which in one case, which is analogous to the Chandler wobble, the two precess together with a very small difference between fluid and crust velocity. And the other case, they precess separately. And are you familiar with this?
Well, I'm familiar with the Shaham work, but so he was looking at what happens when you've got a pin superfluid in the inner crust.
Yeah.
So you've got to add on this piece of angular momentum, and that would make the crust process faster. Right? I don't think there was an argument that that would lock the crust and core together in that way.
Maybe we should discuss it later. I have to disagree that the superfluid is important. The problem was first worked by Poincaré for the Earth, and both of those normal modes are observed for the Earth.
There are a whole load of modes observed for the Earth.
The two mutational normal modes.
So is the other one a free mode?
It is a free mode. It's called the free core mutation.
You know, I've heard of that, but The last paper I read, it hadn't been detected, but maybe that was kind of vague.
There have been claims of detection, and it's important as a forced resonance in earth mutations.
We should talk about it,
but I think it changes the answer slightly.
All right, that's interesting. I'm probably too much longer. There's one other mechanism that would tend to decrease the wobble angle of a processing star, and that, of course, is gravitational radiation reaction. So if you've got a star processing, it's emitting energy, it's emitting angular momentum, so you've got to subtract that back off the source. And this has been looked at by the Todd and Neil in 1973. And the basic picture was that radiation reaction can be written as a local force, and so you add this local force into essentially the Newtonian equations of motion, and you evolve it in time. And the rigid case, they got it right. And I read that paper in correcting the elastic case and believed it, but then it was pointed out to me by Kurt Kuttner that in fact, in the elastic case, the original result was slightly wrong. And very simply, that's because as well as exerting a torque on a spinning elastic star, the radiation reaction force also changes its shape slightly. And what happens is that if you include this change of shape in the problem, it cancels part of the torque terms, the two largest parts. And anyway, if you do the problem including this change of shape, you basically find that gravitational radiation reaction isn't important for compared to internal dissipation, so we can forget about it. So that's the only thing you need to extract from that overhead. But gravitational radiation reaction probably isn't important in this problem. So that was the second part of my talk about damping. Now the final part's about pumping and what possibly can keep a wobbling star alive, what can keep it wobbling, and also ask the question, is that strong enough, is that strong enough to overcome the damping? And so I'm going to skip very quickly through these results. Basically what I've done is I've looked at a few of all of the important things that might exert forces on neutron stars. I've extracted out the sorts of timescales on which these things will act, and I've compared them with the timescales on which the dissipation works to see who wins the battle. And I can tell you at once that in all plausible cases, the battle is won by the damping. I haven't been able to find any plausible scenario in which free precession would be kept alive in a significant way to make it an interesting source. So I looked at accretion torques. Some people had thought a bit previously about what accretion torques would be for precession. But I found that you need that our ideas about the internal damping would have to be off what orders of magnitude for an accretion torque which is in some way locked in with a component of which is locked in phase with the precession in some way to keep the free precession alive. I also looked at electromagnetic torques, which is also shown by Dzhumalatos, and again I found that in all plausible scenarios you're not going to gain much by having a strong magnetic dipole tending to keep the wobble alive. It is true that the electromagnetic torque can pump up the wobble, but of course they also do this other dreadful thing, they spin the star down. So there's not much good keeping a wobble alive if you're also going to spin the star down. So I did another thing which wasn't very easy to justify, it's impossible to justify, which was to imagine there's some component of the electromagnetic pumping torque remains alive in an accreting system. So you've got this nice picture where the accretion keeps the spin rate up, but there's some neozone part of the electromagnetic problem that's keeping the wobble going. But again, the timescales just don't work out. You can't help the wobble well enough. I also suppose that perhaps the neutron stars are born, they might be born processing. Again, hard to justify why. Maybe a series of graphic glitches just after the solidify spin. Do something crazy to them, I don't know. Anyway, if you look at the statistics of how often neutron stars are born in the galaxy, you can follow through the sort of argument that Roger Blanford made for triaxial spinning down stars, and you find that it's unlikely that at any given moment in time, say for any given 1 year's observation, there will be a detectable spinning down young neutron star in our galaxy that we've got a hope of seeing. I also look very briefly at collisions between neutron stars and other stars in dense environments, hoping that perhaps that might kick the star in some way, in some impulsive way, and keep the wobble going. Basically, if a neutron star collides with something, it either collides with a main sequence star, in which case there's no sort of strong impulsive torque on it. You just, I don't know, get a mass, you set up an accretion disk or whatever, but there's no strong kick about it. On the other hand, if you get a neutron star encounter, well, if they get close enough, of course, then we're not interested in quick precession, we're talking about binary spiral. But if they get fairly close, they don't spiral, but they have a near encounter, well, the magnetic interaction is negligible between their two dipoles, but there might be some sort of impulsive gravitational torque. Say one star exerts a torque on the rotational bulge of the other, and that could be impulsive if they have a very close encounter, but the event rate is almost certainly off by orders and orders of magnitude for that to be interesting. So, I'm sorry to have to say it, but I don't think that we've got much hope of detecting a fully processing star if our ideas are right, possibly not even with an advanced instrument. I also thought a little about what are the weakest points of this sort of picture and what things might save us and keep the wobble alive. One way would be following sorts of ideas by Lars Goldstein. If instead of thinking about kicking the star, it in some way has got some way in which it would change shape, some sort of plastic deformation that would tend to keep reorientating the symmetry axis of the moment of inertia, but it's unlikely that it can change shape fast enough. I haven't talked much about prolates, in other words, long and thin, as opposed to short and fat deformations, because it turns out that internal damping mechanisms tend to increase the wobble of these prolate things, but they're relatively physically unlikely. But if they do exist in nature, they might be interesting in this problem. And finally, modeling the fluid motion in a more complicated way and then opening up more and more degrees of freedom for the internal fluid. Because all of the ways in which people have looked at free precession with a liquid involved, they haven't had many degrees of freedom in the fluid. So perhaps a more complete treatment of that might give a greater insight. But as I say, in the main, unless there's something wrong with the way in which we're looking at the problem, the chances don't seem terribly good of detecting these things gravitation.
Have you considered more exotic compositions, like for instance, lots of strange stars with normal material crust actually have like a vacuum gap separating the two?
I've not looked at those. If I was to look at something exotic, and I will, I think I would look at the possibility of a solid core, because then you can have a relatively large rigidity parameter. Whereas I suspect that for these strange crusts, because the gravitation...
It's questions of what is sort of the behavior of the material at high density. All neutron stars have strange cores.
Well, a core is much better than a crust, because the ability of gravity to make it spherical as compared to the ability of, say, if it's crystalline, the crystalline forces to make it non-spherical, that's better for smaller, compact solids. So.
And the reason I mentioned the strange plus normal matter is that it's almost no damping again.
But does it, the strange story is you have much thinner crust, so then your rigidity parameter would go even lower than the...
This is the one that's damping.
So you get the advantage of no damping, you get the disadvantage of having a much lower rigidity.
I've not looked at that, and that's a good point. I'll think about that.
Is it possible in principle that the radiation back reaction would cause the wobble to be unstable, to be growing unstable, like in a Friedman-Schultz kind of mechanism?
Well, this is a good question, and I think the answer is no. In fact, in the original Bertotti calculation, when I sort of redid it in the sort of notation that I use here, it did seem that there was such an instability, and I was quite excited about that. But then it was basically Kirkland found that when he put in the extra terms, it went away. So I don't think that there's much room, at least not for any of the sort of simple models of free precession that I've looked at. But I don't think there's any room for instability, even though I would love that to be one. I don't think there is.
And I have a question about, again, a silly one, but it's a simple case. Can I just briefly get
to that? So, Billy, we'll get you next, okay?
Sorry.
She's
up. So, in the simple...
Light on Andrew, passing.
In the simple biaxial case, right, with its axis, okay, there's a principal axis and simply like this, and then there's two more which are equal to this axis. Sorry, okay, so there's one axis like this and then two more which are equal, but the moment of inertia along the other two is equal because it's axis metric by assumption. Okay?
Do you want to borrow the microphone? Okay. Okay, so now if the rotation axis is along E3, then there is no precession. It can't be that, because you never get precession for rigid body if you have omega along E3. Axisymmetric spinning body. Exactly. Yeah. Perfect path. Exactly. Okay, so now, suppose that I put the rotation axis initially like this. Then there will be a precession around here, okay?
Around the angular momentum.
Around it. This thing will move around that axis, right, around the angular momentum axis, say, every 100 years. Let's just pretend. But it's also spinning around this axis every, let's say, 1 second. I'm just
right, so you've got what I call the inertial spin frequency in the body frame. Okay.
Now, why isn't, I guess my confusion is, why isn't there going to be gravitational variation at 1 second, at 1 hertz, when you have an asymmetry which is not aligned with the rotation?
What is the observer
infinity series? Right. I can answer this just by, is that finished? That cut back. You're trying to resist? Right. No, let's keep it rigid. Right, so if you've got your observing position, right. So let me put this on. So if you sit in your observing station, and I'm over here with the neutron star. Okay, so the free precession consists of this motion. All right. Now, not only is the symmetry axis of this cut moving in a cone, there's also a rotation about that axis. I don't care about that axis, because when this coat cut rotates about that axis,
yes,
there's no change in the mass quadrupole moment, and it's the mass quadrupole...
Because
no,
the mass quadrupole is...
You can see, look, can you see it? Yeah. Okay. Andrew, look at this. Can you see it changing? Mm-hmm. It's rotating about the symmetry axis.
Excuse me. Where is the angular momentum axis in this picture?
So if it's your bright star, it's there. And in general, if the body's not too far away from being spherical, this angle here is much smaller than this one here. And it's this one here that's the what I call the wobble angle. And so there are three vectors in that plane, the vector along the symmetry axis, the angular momentum vector, and the angular velocity vector are in a plane, and they're always in a plane. And that plane rotates pretty fast about J, about the angular momentum vector. And it's the rotation frequency of that plane that is the gravitational wave frequency.
If that's true, I'm afraid I don't understand why Andrew's comment isn't correct, because the angular momentum axis must be pointing in a single direction in space.
Yeah.
And so the E3 axis is in fact turning around it.
Yeah,
at omega.
No. What's omega? I mean, the simplest way to describe a free precessing body is in terms of two angular frequencies, neither of which should really be called the spin frequency. Okay? There's one, let me explain. There's one rotation frequency, which is the angular frequency at the tip of this E3 vector about J. So that's fast, and it's what I call the inertial precession frequency. And it's that frequency at which a small wobble angle is released, most of the gravitational waves are coming out at. And you can see that's true, because the only thing that you care about as a gravitational wave observer is what the mass quadrupole looks like projected into this plane. And every one rotation, that mass quadrupole returns to its original orientation. So that has to be the gravitational wave spin frequency. Now it's true that over this interval, there's been a compound rotation of the body about this symmetry axis.
Are you rotating the object as it rotates on the sky there? Can you turn it again?
This is what it does. Plus a bit of that.
So I think the question people are asking is in the case where it's spinning about this axis fast, which is hard for you to do by your hand, when that, let's say that frequency is 1 hertz, and this is once per day. People
want to
know where
it is. Oh, no.
But his point is that, no, as you look at that thing, it doesn't change on the frequency at which it spins. That is body axis. So,
in the case that's being done there, that the E3 axis, that cup, is coming like directly out of the cup.
Yes.
Okay, so if you spin it around that axis, then omega and E3 are in the same direction. And for a rigid body, that means no precession.
I'm not completely understanding why this is a problem. Because I explain once more what the motion is, and then that argument will agree on what the frequency is of the gravitational radiation.
Okay, but
let's
go
ahead. Sure.
Yeah, thanks. So, here's the axis symmetric body, and the E3 axis is coming up out of the coke thing, right? So this is what free precession is.
And
right?
Where's the angle? Axis.
Here's the angular momentum axis, okay. Straight up.
And the spin axis is that as well.
And so here's the symmetry. Let me orientate myself like that. Here's the angular momentum back there. Here's the symmetry axis along the coke pan. And the angular velocity, the instantaneous angular velocity vector, is moving around the whole time, but the instantaneous position would be at a small angle up here.
Yeah.
All right? And that's the problem would be very complicated if you thought about it in terms of that instantaneous angular velocity vector. So I'm not going to think about it in that way. I'm going to decompose, if you like, the total angular velocity into two parts. So first of all, the body will rotate about, sorry, the symmetry axis rotates in a cone of constant angle about J, okay? Like that. And superimposed on that fast rotation, there's a slow rotation about the symmetry axis. Now that slow rotation, I mean, it's important
dynamically.
For a prolate body, the superimposed rotation is in the same sense as the overall rotation. For an oblate body, it's in the opposite sense.
I'm afraid I disagree.
This is classical mechanics.
Are you familiar with the Poinsot instruction? The cones?
I think that's a really complicated way of thinking about it, but yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to have to. Vicky, ask your question. Sorry, I think we're going to have to. Vicky, do we have a question? You're still there?
Yeah, I am. I was going to ask what the nine-dimensional axis of observer question is, just as starting your talk, you mentioned the stairs at all results, which seems like, to me, we just had Ingrid Stairs speak here in Montreal last week, and it seems like very nice evidence for a possessing neutron star, and I just wonder if you have any speculations about how that could be, given what you've shown in your talk.
Oh, so you're asking about the recent observation, and you're asking how I think it came about. All right, I don't know much about the history of this object. I haven't got a very good off-the-cuff answer. What I've done is I've looked at their data, their free precession data, and I think it looks pretty plausible if pinning isn't important. But as for actually what got it going in the first place, I suppose the most obvious thing to say, even though it's a rather slowly spinning star, is that maybe there was some sort of glitch, and that happened in a rather non-axisymmetric way and got it all going. But I wouldn't put any money on it.
I thought you were saying that the internal dissipation would pretty much get rid of any precession on a fairly short time
scale. That's right, yeah. So it would have to have occurred relatively recently to glitch. Yeah.
Chris, last question. This has nothing to do with the frequency. The frequency of frame dragging is larger than the precession frequency.
You mean it's a relativistic?
Yeah, I mean, does anything interesting happen in that limit?
I don't know anything about that. There has been one paper by Thorn and someone else looking at what happens in the relativistic case, and they concluded it was rather like the Newtonian case, but with the moment of inertia tensor being integrals over, relative in a relativistic way. But I'm afraid I don't know anything about the frame dragging and how that depends on.
Okay, so let's thank you. No, sorry, Derek.